gives me great pleasure to introduce today Amir Tahari, a man who I have always read but never met until this morning. But every time his articles and analyses on Iran and the entire region appear in the Western press, we pay attention to them here. Just to run by a few biographical points of background, he was born in Iran, educated in Tehran, London, and Paris. Between 1980 and 1984, he was the Middle East editor of the London Sunday Times. And from 1984 to 1987, he was editor-in-chief of Jeune Afrique. And, of course, between 72 and 79, he was editor-in-chief of Kayan, Iran's main daily newspaper. The biography goes on and on, but the main point is that I don't think there's anybody who today is writing on the Middle East who has a keener understanding of events going on inside Iran and how Iran is affecting the entire region, whether you're talking about the Gulf region, Lebanon, our situation here in the Israel and among our neighbors. So we'll get started. Please, Mr. Tahari.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Thank you all for coming here. I'm very happy to be in Israel. And I was especially glad that I came here on the Holocaust Remembrance Day to convey to the Israelis the true sentiments of the Iranian people. We don't share Mr. Ahmadinejad's sentiments. He does not represent the Iranians in free and fair elections. And the people of Iran have the deepest of sympathies for the Jewish people throughout history. And this morning I visited the Yad Vashem, and I was really moved. I came even a bit late here for that reason. I suggest that I make a few remarks about the present situation in Iran, and then since I suffer from arthritis in my left knee, I will sit down and take the questions, and we'll have the question and answer session afterwards. People often ask me why is Iran behaving like that, you know, obviously in many cases against its own interest, against its own national interest. For example, look at the Iranian policy in Transcaucasia, you know, something that you may not be familiar with, and I choose it deliberately to illustrate the point that I'll make later. In Transcaucasia, there has been a long quarrel between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave, which is an Armenian enclave in Azerbaijan province, or at the time, and now Azerbaijan Republic. And it is separated from the other bit of Azerbaijan, which is Nakhchivan, by an area called the Lachin Uplands, or the Lachin Mountains. And this has been going on since 1992. When you look at it, of the two sides, the side closest to Iran is, of course, Azerbaijan, because there are 7 million Azerbaijanis in the Republic of Azerbaijan, but there are about 15 to 18 million Azeris in Iran. They are Shiites. They were part of Iran until 1830, so they are flesh and blood of Iran. Quite obviously. But in this dispute, if you like, the Islamic Republic very paradoxically is supporting Armenia against Azerbaijan. Why? Because Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan, is pro-West, pro-American, and this is the only yardstick that matters for the Islamic Republic. The yardstick is not Iran's national interests; it is enmity with the United States. Inside Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan itself, the situation gets even more interesting, because the Islamic Republic is supporting the Sunni minority in the Talesh and Lenkran area of Azerbaijan against the Shia majority, which is in power in Baku. So it means that even on religious grounds, naturally, you know, Islamic Republic, mullahs, Shiism, and so on, they should support the Shiites in Azerbaijan, not the Sunnis. Why? Because the Sunnis, since the time of President Ayaz Motalebov were pro-Russian, pro-Soviet, and so on, and anti-American. So Iran is behaving in a very strange way. So when you meet Azerbaijan, you say, Baba, what's wrong with you? Why are you behaving like that? In Afghanistan, the same. Iran's natural interest is to support the Persian speakers. The Islamic Republic is supporting the Pashtun speakers who hate Iranians and Persian speakers. They are supporting Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Sarzai tribe, and now the Taliban. Now, this brings me to Israel. If you look at Israel and Iran, Iran's national interest is to regard Israel as its strategic ally and its strategic partner. Why? Because Iran as a nation does not want a Middle East that is purely and entirely Arab. Iran does not want Abdul Halim Hafez's famous song under Abdul Nasser, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, all of it becoming Arabized. You know, it is also in our interest to have a Middle East in which there are Persians, Kurds, Turks, Jews, Maronites, Christians, Copts, everybody. So obviously, who is our strategic partner and ally in the region? If we think of Iran as a nation state, it is Israel. And had there not been an Israel, all the negative energies of Arab chauvinism and pan-Arabism would have been directed against Iran. They were calling, and to some extent still do, the Persian Gulf as Arabian Gulf. You know, they have a claim on our oil province of Khuzestan, which they call Arabistan. They call us Gabr and Majis, you know, and all this Rafizis, you know, all the worst insults possible to deny that we are even Muslims. And last month, it's still April, this month, few days ago, the Saudi High Council of Fatwas, this is, you know, the top of the creme de la creme of the Saudi clergy, issued a very long, detailed fatwas that the creation of the Fatimid dynasty in Egypt was a Persian conspiracy, and that the founder of the dynasty was a member of the Iranian secret services of the time, something like the Mossad of Iran in the 9th century. And they sent him there to create this Fatimid dynasty in order to sabotage Islam. Now, you know, the whole thing is, of course, completely nonsense, because, you know, at that time, Iran was Sunni, the Fatimids were Shiites, and the Fatimids were fighting Iran in the name of Shiism. But, you know, it shows the attitude of refusal to accept Iranians as they are, whether in their the way they practice their Islam, whether they practice their nationality, their culture, etc. So Israel normally should be Iran's best ally in the region. But when we look at Iran as the Islamic Republic, Israel should be its number one ally. Why? Because the Islamic Republic wants to lead the Muslim world, create an Islamic superpower, save mankind from perdition as a result of this Judeo-Christian conspiracy, which means the modern civilization, and show them the right path, etc. But to do that, the Arabs and other Muslims who are majority Sunni, they will not accept the Shiite Iran as leader. So how to deal with that problem? The way to deal with it is to tell the Arabs, look, you know, your best dream is to destroy Israel. I'll do it for you. Accept my leadership. Follow me. Forget about my Shiism. And let us unite politically. You saw that. I don't know. Maybe some of you watched the debate recently between former President of Islamic Republic, Mr. Rafsanjani, and Qaradawi, who is now the kind of big cheese of the Sunni fundamentalist movement on Al Jazeera. It was very, very interesting. It was obvious that the two clerics, they could not agree on a single point of religion. The only thing they could agree upon was to destroy Israel. So, you know, this has become also a device to avoid any theological discussions. A couple of years ago, I was trying to do a paper for the Institute of Public Policy Research in the UK about Muslims in Britain. And I went around, you know, I attended lots of mosques and madrasas, you know, in various parts. And it was very interesting that in all these places, the only thing people did not talk about was religion. God would make a cameo appearance every now and then, but you know, the whole thing was entirely political. And I wondered, you know, is it a religion? Is it a political movement? You know, what is it? It looks like a duck, you know, it quacks like a duck, but somehow it's not a duck. And a Palestinian British militant, Dr. Tamimi, he solved the problem for me by telling me two things. First of all, he said that if we talk to our Muslim brethren from other parts about religion, we will immediately quarrel, because you know, there are different, many different sects and many different interpretations. For example, Shiism, in my opinion, is a different religion than Sunnism. Anyway, you know, Islam has three principles. The Shiites added two more, so already it becomes something else. So the best way not to run into trouble with our brethren is to avoid religion, talk about politics. Israel, Chechnya, Kashmir, liberation of Andalusia, you know, the usual things, and we can all agree. And the second thing, which was also significant, he told me, was that for a long time I wondered why the British media almost never invite me or people like me to appear on television and radio. But recently, in the past 3-4 years, everybody is calling me. You know, I have no time. You know, I'm just become a media star. And I wondered why it happened. He said, I realized that it's because of Iraq. Because, you know, I speak against the Americans in Iraq, so everybody wants to have me. So these two facts put together illustrates that avoidance of religious issues and the finding of common political causes has become a necessity for a religion whose theology has died. You know, there is no Islamic theology anymore. You know, for the past, I think the last great theologian, Mullah Sadra of Shiraz, was in 18th century. So, you know, an atrophied religion has been hijacked by radicals and militants and transformed into a political movement. And this political movement, of course, needs enemies and so on. We experience it in the case of Iran. For example, the Islamic Republic has created a special corps to liberate Jerusalem, Sepah-e-Quds, for the liberation of Jerusalem. And of course, Quds is the wrong word in Persian, because the word for Jerusalem in Persian is Beit al-Muqaddas. And you know, the word Quds is a recently invented Arabic word that the Arabs themselves didn't use it either. They invented it and started using it from the 60s onwards. Anyway, so now suppose we come and liberate Jerusalem. What's the good of it for us? You know, first of all, as a nation state, we have liberated Jerusalem. There is no natural resources. There isn't a big market. It's not of any strategic value to us, and so on. Now, what about the religious aspect? Suppose, you know, we need it for religious purposes. Again, it is of little use to us, because when we have liberated Jerusalem, we'll have the mosques of Omar and Al-Aqsa, but they are Sunni mosques. We can't go and pray there. We are Shiites. And if we go and pray there, our prayer would not be accepted. So, you know, it's a totally useless project from both the religious side and the national side. But of course, Iran is not exceptional in experiencing this schizophrenia, this Jekyll and Hyde situation. It has happened to all countries that experience revolution. For example, France is as a nation is something. France as an expression of Napoleon and the standard of the French Revolution is something else. Russia is not the same thing as the Soviet Union. So the real issue in Iran is how to find a way to enable Iran to come out of this revolutionary experience, absorb it, keep part of it, discard part of it, and so on, and re-become a nation state. And once it has become a re-become a nation state, then it will have the normal behavior of a nation state. It could still misbehave, like for example, Russia under Putin is a very nasty regime, but it's not an existential threat to anybody. It's just misbehaving. A nation state's demands are tangible and quantifiable. It would be about borders, sharing waters, markets, access to raw materials, influence, security, geopolitics, you know, the usual things. But the problem with a country being a cause is that the cause is an abstract thing. And, you know, if you are the holder of this cause, you want everything. You don't want specific things, you know, so that you can do a give and take with the other side in any form of negotiation. So whenever I hear people say, let's talk to Iran, and I've heard it even here in Israel, I'm no longer, of course, surprised. I used to be surprised, but now I just laugh. Because, you know, first of all, which Iran are you going to talk about? And the assumption that, you know, nobody has been talking to Iran is ridiculous. Everybody has been talking to Iran all the time from the beginning of this regime. You know, the talks between the Americans and the Khomeini regime started before Khomeini came to power. The Americans sent George Cave, former CIA hand, to Paris and established contact with Khomeini, told him, you know, we have nothing against you. You are a man of God. President Carter himself is a born-again Christian. And then Mr. Andrew Young, the UN ambassador of Mr. Carter, described Khomeini as a 20th century saint. So it was all hunky-dory. And a few months after the success of revolution, Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor, met Bazargan, the Khomeini's prime minister in Algiers, and they agreed on very nice things, including resumption of military supplies from the United States to the Islamic Republic, which, you know, by the way, the crates are still packed at Kennedy Airport, left there. But then a few days later, they raided the U.S. embassy and seized the hostages and so on. And I recently did an article about all the Iranian politicians who negotiated with the U.S. and how all of them committed suicide, political suicide. None of them survived. You know, it's a whole list, which shows, you know, that there has been a long process of negotiation. Another problem is that you have never heard the Islamic Republic formulate any demand. You know, you ask them in one of the Davos sessions, Shimon Peres was trying to ask the Islamic Republic's ambassador to UN, said, but what is it that you want? There was nothing in particular that he wanted. What does he want? You know, the only thing he wants from Israel is not to exist, and this is very difficult to deliver. You know, yes, we are arriving at a moment which is a very dangerous moment, and because it's a dangerous moment, it's also full of opportunities, because usually dangers and opportunity go together, at least according to the Chinese. But the Middle East, the equilibrium that exists in the Middle East, the status quo that exists in the Middle East has been shattered as a result of the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Now it is a moment of disequilibrium. The new Middle East will either be an American Middle East, you know, let's not put a fine point on it, which means it would be a democratic, pluralist, capitalist, great satanic, whatever you like it, good or bad. You know, this is one option. The other option, it would be, again, you know, it's not a question of judgment. It would be a Khomeinist Middle East. It would be heavenly, maybe, But you know, these are two different visions, and these two different visions are in competition. The original calculation of the leadership of the Islamic Republic was to wait President Bush out, because they think George Bush is an aberration. He's an atypical American. He's a bit crazy like ourselves. He might still hit us if we hit him, so let's wait until he's finished. But in recent months, my feeling is that they decided that they don't even have to wait Bush out, and that Bush is already finished, and the quote-unquote good Americans will soon be back in power. Therefore, the Islamic Republic has gone on the offensive. And you see this going on the offensive in Iraq. You see it in Lebanon. You see it in Afghanistan. You see it in Pakistan, fomenting the Baluchi rebellion. You see it in the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, when for the first time since 1988, the Islamic Republic Navy is stopping ships and inspecting them, you know, as a show of flag that we are there, the Americans are going, we are coming, seizing the British sailors, intensifying attacks on allied forces in the parts of Iraq that were not affected by insurgency. All of it are signals that they are going and we are coming. And certain that the U.S. will cut and run, they want to take the credit for themselves. They want to say it, we did it. It was not Al-Qaeda who did it. It's not Ba'athist remnants, desperados who did it. It's not the Sunnis supported by the King of Jordan, among others, and the President of Syria and the princes of the Arabian Peninsula and so on. We did it. And now we are the leaders of the region. So, you know, this situation exists. Those who are going to be affected by it, that means everybody in the region, the Arabs in the Persian Gulf, who are scared stiff even by the peaceful use of Iran's nuclear energy, because you know the Iranian nuclear plant is 132 kilometers from Kuwait, 150 kilometers from Qatar. Its polluted waters will be poured in the Gulf, where they get 90% of their water through desalination. The nuclear plant has a German design, but it is built by a Russian company, the same company that built Chernobyl. So, you know, the Arabs are scared. And it is located on one of the most active earthquake zones in the world. A few months ago, National Geographic published a special issue on earthquakes. If you get hold of it, you will see that this area, Helia, where the plant is being built, is bang over there. And what the a few people outside know, that you know the scientists at Tehran University have already sent a big report about 2 years ago to the regime that this is a wrong site, don't pick it, because the assumption of the designers, the German designers, was that the plant that they are building, provided the Germans built it, not the Russians anyway, would resist an earthquake of up to 7 Richter on the Richter scale. And historic records show that there was no earthquake bigger than 7 in the region. But historic records in this area started in 1953. You know, and who is crazy enough to go and build a nuclear plant there? So the obvious conclusion is that it is not really a nuclear plant. The question is not energy and things like that, which Iran doesn't need. You know, this is a camouflage, you know, for something else. You know, they want to do something else. Now, the big problem I notice when I talk to those concerned about the situation, you know, the Arabs, the Russians, the Europeans, you know, the Pakistanis, everybody, they have two observations. First of all, that what interest do we have to go and pressure the Islamic Republic and do everything we can to make life difficult for them? Because if we do that, if their back is to the wall, at the 11th hour, they go and make a deal with the Americans. And we are left in the lurch. So what's the good of it for us? The second assumption is that The Iranians, if they get really out of hand and they want to do something really, really nasty, the Americans will take care of them. So, you know, on both sides, the key suddenly ends up in the hands of the United States. Whether as the ultimate solver of the problem or as the ultimate wielder of the dagger, which would be a stab in your back if you help them. This is the problem we face now, and this analysis prevents the Iranian opposition from going really onto the offensive, risking their lives. You know, Iran today is full of strikes, full of activities against the regime, and so on. But they all keep it at a level because they fear that if they force the regime too much, they will go and make a deal with the Americans. The Arabs feel the same, the Pakistanis, the Turks, you know, the Russians, the Europeans, and so on. But in my opinion, at this moment in time, there is a good chance to change this regime because the present regime in Iran is so constituted, it is so dependent on its political DNA that it cannot change its behavior. You know, even if they wanted it, you know, it's not a question of individuals. Even Archangel Gabriel himself, if he came to rule Iran, he can't change it. So this is really the central issue that we face, whether we are going for regime change in Iran or for behavior change. Thank you.
Before we get into the questions, I just wanted to take the privilege of the chairperson and ask a question myself. As someone who also looks at the Arab world and not just Iran and the dynamics between them, why do you think, given the enhanced threat that Iran is posing to the Gulf states, that Saudi Arabia decided to host the Arab summit this time and even entertain the possibility of a peace initiative vis-a-vis Israel if the Saudis and others are concerned about Iranian operations against them? Wouldn't the very beginning of the start of negotiations with Israel only undermine them and leave them exposed to all kinds of Iranian accusations against their loyalty to the Islamic cause?
Thank you. Yes, of course, these accusations have happened, but you know, it's again out of their desperation that no one else is doing something to deal with the situation created by this rivalry between Iran and the United States, that they are trying in their own way somehow to do two things. First of all, to stiffen the backbones of their own elites, to say that, you know, we are not going to the slaughterhouse very easily. Saudi Arabia has many cards to play. You know, it could wreck the Islamic Republic's economy by producing 1 million or 2 million barrels more oil, which they have the reserves. And believe me, they went out of their way to advise the Islamic Republic leaders to alter course, and they failed. You know, don't forget that in the past 2.5 years, former President Khatami has been to Saudi Arabia, Rafsanjani has been there, people close to the Supreme Guide, Khamenei, has been there, The Saudi Foreign Minister, the head of the Saudi National Security Council, several other emissaries, they have been telling recently, King Abdullah called Ahmadinejad to Riyadh and told him, you are like my son, you know, I give you fatherly advice, you are wrong, you know, do not underestimate the trouble that you are stirring, it will boomerang to you and so on, but no effect. And the reason is that whatever the Islamic Republic has done so far has been cost-free. You know, they haven't lost anything. And Ahmadinejad comes and says, you know, why are you all defeated? What has happened to us? Nothing. You know, so why should we give something for nothing? He thinks, you know, he's on the ascendancy. He describes the Western civilization as the sunset civilization, or Fuli, and the Islamic civilization as the Tului, the sunrise civilization. So
The Saudis are scared. What they are trying to do is two things. Is first of all to create some elements of stability in the region, because this region lacks anchors. And they are doing this by negotiating with NATO. As you know, already six Arab countries have special agreements with NATO, and now the Saudis are negotiating, the Kuwaitis, Qataris, Bahrainis, and all others, in the hope that at least this NATO, I personally, I think they are too optimistic, because NATO is useless. But, you know, they think that in their, if the Americans run away, somehow, you know, there will be a connection there with NATO, and through that with Turkey, which they also have a lot of hope for Turkey. If Turkey does not feel happy with this European adventure, maybe he comes back to play a regional role. So they created this group of eight, which means six GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council member states, plus Egypt and Jordan. And next to it, they created another group of seven, this time, you know, with Islamic countries like Pakistan, Indonesia, and Malaysia, plus Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and so on. And for the first time since 1969, they excluded Iran, because Iran was, there were eight. This was the Syrian Committee of Eight. Iran was excluded from the last summit. They didn't invite Ahmadinejad. As you can see, all these meetings and the Arab summit recently, all of them are laying markers for a third vision of the Middle East. I explained the American vision and the Islamic Republic vision. Their ambition is to say, no, there is a third vision too. We are there too. We don't want to live in a Khomeinist Middle East. And if the Americans are not ready to defend their project, if the Bush doctrine is dead, they could at least play a supporting role in our version of the Middle East. But these are early days, and I think they are sincere, because they have to, not out of the goodness of their heart. Because, you know, they have the Khomeini's gun pointed at their head.
Ehud, everyone, when you speak, just identify yourself for the record and so on.
My name is Ehud Yari. I'm from Channel 2 Television. I would like to take a different approach than Doris and ask you, one, do you feel that the Iranian feelers for some sort of a security defense pact with the GCC may fly? This is one. The second is, could you go a bit into the relationship between the Sadri current in Iraq and the Iranian regime, Al-Quds Soleimani? And number three, Mahdi Khalaj wrote a beautiful paper on the end of the Marja'iyya. And he's saying, his argument is Sistani is the last great Marja. Do you agree?
Well, let's start with the third question. Although I'm Iranian and from the Middle East, I'm not a prophet. So I don't know whether this is the last marja and so on. I haven't read the article. You said it may be beautiful, but I can assure you that Sistani will not be the last marja. Anyway, but that's besides the point. The first question, no, the second question was about the Sadrist movement. Well, the Saad family are a very big Iranian family from the city of Mahallat, southwest of Tehran. And in fact, one of his great uncles was prime minister of Iran, Javad Sadr, known as Sadr Rashavi. He was minister of justice and so on. Because, you know, the Shiite in Iraq, at the level of theological leadership, they are run by seven Iranian families. You know, Sistani is one of them, Khoi, another one, Ghazvini, Isfahani, Shirazi, and of course, Sadr Mahallati was one there too. But after the liberation of Iraq, Muqtada Sadr started trying to fly the banner of pan-Arabism and accused Sistani of being Iranian. So you see, he's a foreigner, a Persian, and whereas I'm the real McCoy, he was born in Najaf. So I'm the real Iraqi, authentic Shiite, and so on. At that time, my advice to the Americans was to hire him, because he wanted money, and especially, you know, I advised him to have his teeth done as well, because he has very bad teeth, and he wanted attention. But of course, nobody paid any attention to him, and he attacked the Iranians very bitterly. I even criticized the mullahs in Tehran. Again, the Americans didn't talk to him. So he decided to switch sides and switch to the Iranian side. What he did not realize was that the Iranians, they don't want allies, they want agents. You know, and this is what Hezbollah has also found out, and Hamas will soon find out if they continue in their present trajectory. So Sadr gradually became a tool of the Islamic Republic. And politically, I think this is suicidal for him. He had at one point the possibility of appealing to the Iraqi Shiites by telling them you can have it both ways, both be Arabs and Shiites. He has lost that. So now, of course, the Iranians have told him to, when the surge policy was announced in Washington, the Iranians told him to lie low, the Mahdi army disappeared, and so on. But now, as the analysis in Tehran has changed, as I explained, they think it's time to go on the offensive. They have asked him to return. He's still in Yazd, but, you know, I think he'll return very soon and start doing a mischief big enough to go on American television in preparation of the Tehran's calculation that the Americans will run away, start running away from August of this year, which means very, very soon, and to claim credit for it. And of course, he's related to many families in Lebanon, including Nasrallah. He's also related by blood to Nasrallah, to the missing Imam Musa Sadr's family, and so on. So he's a player, but, you know, he's a player in this context. If the context changes, he's dead. Bah, bah, salam. What do you want to do?
After that introduction, hi, my name is Yusuf Hakimian. I have a question that puzzles me. Oh, I'm sorry. Go to the microphone. Okay.
Please begin again.
آقای طاهری سلام عرض میکنم، خوش آمدید. من یوسف حکیمیان هستم. My name is Yusuf Hakimian. And I have a question. How is this nation that I feel tremendous affinity toward because it's the land of my birth can be saved from those demons who are ruling it? And I am not a Muslim, but the brand of Islam that they are representing is totally strange to me, and I am familiar with Islam. So how, in your opinion, can they be saved?
Thank you very much. First of all, you are lucky if there is only one question that puzzles you about Iran. You are one lucky Iranian. We have millions of questions that puzzle us. But you are right. You know, a very important thing to understand is that the present Islamic Republic regime in Iran is based on Khomeinism as an ideology, which is a kind of Islamofascism. You know, it is we are not fighting a religious regime. We are fighting a regime that is using religious symbols and discourse and icons and lexicon as well as part of a broader ideology. In fact, maybe you don't know it, but there are more mullahs in prison in Iran today than any other category of Iranians, than workers or intellectuals or other people. And the reason is that the majority of the Shiite clergy in Iran and elsewhere, it is almost 100%, but in Iran too, the majority are against this regime. You know, of all the grand ayatollahs,
The last of them that was still cooperating with the regime until the 80s was Montazeri, who was supposed to be Khomeini's successor. They are now all bitter enemies of this regime. The Grand Ayatollahs in Najaf, that is Sistani, that is Bashir Najafi, that is Ishaq, that is Mohsen Hakim, all of them are opposed to this distortion of the Shiite theology. Grand Ayatollah Tabatabai Qomi in Qom, who is the primus inter pares of the Shiite clergy in Iran, is opposed to this regime. Ayatollah Sanei in Qom, Ayatollah Wahidi in Qom. So you know, it's not a fight against religion. And as far as Islam is concerned, in fact, they are giving Islam a bad name, even in Iran itself. You know, I cite you one anecdote, if you have time. I have a friend, Paulo Coelho, who is a Brazilian novelist. And he said, I've fallen in love with Iran and I want to go to Iran and so on. So I persuaded him very strongly and introduced him to lots of friends. He went to Iran and he was really moved by the reception he had. For example, in Shiraz, 5,000 people came at the airport to greet him. So he said, in order to thank the Iranians who gave me a hero's welcome, I want to institute a literary prize in the form of $5,000 or $10,000 a year to translate one Persian work into a living European, modern European language so that it could be published. So the Paulo Coelho Prize was established and so on. The Ministry of Islamic Orientation and Guidance intervened. He said, no, you can't do that. You know, there has to be an Islamic aspect to it too. What about offering two prizes? One for an original work of fiction or poetry or whatever, and the other one for Islamic studies. And we are ready also to contribute. He said, okay, so you know, they put two prizes. And since the prize has been given in 2001, he gets thousands of submissions of fiction and poetry, nothing in Islamic studies. Nobody is interested. You know, and the truth of the matter is that before the revolution in Iran, we had poets, novelists, filmmakers, playwrights who were Islamists, or at least Islamic, or at least believers. Today, we don't have any. There isn't even one. You know, the whole of the culture-producing section of Iranian society has been de-Islamicized. And this is, you know, one of the achievements of the present regime. How to help the Iranian people is by helping those who are fighting the regime inside Iran. These are, at the moment, as we talk, mostly Iranian workers, industrial workers, that have been on the strike in many, many areas. And now the big fight they have is about a new labor code that the Islamic Republic wants to introduce in violation of Iran's commitments under International Labor Organization rules. They want to bring a labor code, they call it Islamic, but it is really a slavery in which the worker has absolutely no rights, in fact. But the funny thing is that the trade unions in the West refuse to support them. Why? Because they think it would be something good for the American and for the Bush administration. So our efforts, you know, to persuade the American trade unions, the British trade unions, French trade unions, in the name of proletarians of the world unite and class solidarity and all that nonsense, at least to come and help their own brethren. And I said, yes, but you know, how do we know? Maybe, you know, the bottom line is that anybody who is against America is a good guy. And this is one group. The other group that are fighting are, of course, women. Are very, very active in Iran, especially in hundreds of NGOs. Then segments of Iranian society that have liberated themselves, or at least they have wrested away some space from the regime, like professional associations, lawyers' associations, doctors' associations, so on, who elect their own leaders. They are also resisting in their own way. I'm sure the regular Iranian armed forces, which is distinct from the revolutionary
guards is also very unhappy from the present situation. Iran as a nation state has very strong and deep-rooted the forces inside in Iran, whereas the forces that represent Iran as a revolution, in my opinion, are shallow. They are maintaining their power because they control the instruments of coercion. They can kill people, and because they control the oil money, and they have 2 or 3 or 5 million people linked to them through favoritism and favor distribution. The rest of the world should come and say, we are ready to help Iran return as a nation state. But Iran as an Islamic republic, we will not allow it to go on the rampage.
We'll take two more questions, General Amijor and Pinchas Inbari.
It's understood from your papers around the world that you are more optimistic than many others about what's going on in Iraq now and might happen after the Americans will leave. Can you elaborate more about your conception about Iraq?
Well, I don't like to be called optimistic because it makes it a subjective thing. Realistic, I would say. You know, when I look at Iraq, I see there are two Iraqs. There is one Iraq as an issue of domestic politics in the U.S. and Britain. All those who hate Bush, America, Blair, and so on, they are using it as a means of settling scores and pursuing their own political aims. And it is for me, obvious why they do it. You know, in the next American presidential election, the Democrat Party will have nothing except Iraq. You know, they must prove that Iraq was a disaster, it was a failure, and so on. And now we have come to clean the mess. But if in 2 years' time Iraq is okay, you know, and people do not appear to be in dire straits, then what happens? You know, they have nothing to offer. So, you know, they are determined to do everything in their power to make Iraq a failure. In fact, they are trying to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, which is the opposite of what is usually done. The same thing in Britain. But now let us see what has happened in Iraq. The Americans achieved all their objectives in this war. The objective number one was to topple Saddam Hussein, which they did. To break his war machine, they did it. To break his machinery of repression, they did it. To verify that whether he has weapons of mass destruction or not, and they verified that he didn't. To allow the Iraqis to write a constitution, hold their elections, whatever is necessary to create a new system, and all of it has happened on the dot, on the dates, or at least 2 or 3 days sometimes earlier, as planned. So in terms of war aims, this has been a very successful war with very little expenditure in human sacrifice and so on. I don't want to minimize anybody's losses, but you know, winning a country the size of France, you know, and changing the course of its history with 3,000 dead, it has never happened in history. So don't forget that Iraq is a country the size of France, which would be about Israel is about 4% of Iraq, I think, or 3.5% of Iraq, just to see the size of the country. And there are 18,000 villages, there are 290 towns, there are 18 provinces, and 90% of the violence you see is happening in five neighborhoods of Baghdad, plus the province of Al-Anbar, and in two or three places in the suburbs of Baghdad, which is called the Sunni Triangle. But, you know, television, because it's like a microscope, magnifies everything. You know, they show a suicide bomber, you think the whole of Iraq is blown up. The same in Israel, you know, they show there is a suicide bomber attacking somewhere, and my aunt phones me from California, you go to the Middle East, you weren't around there. I said, you know, I haven't been near Israel for 20 years, what are you talking about? So, you know, this impression is created. I have always had, since covering Iraq since 1969,
That was one of my very first assignments as a young reporter. I found Iraq an enigmatic society, very secretive, not easy to cover. And over the years, I developed a formula, if I call it Tahrir's secret formula, for understanding what's happening in Iraq, and I give it to you free of charge. So next time you don't need me, you don't need the New York Times or the CNN or anybody. You know, just apply this formula and you will know how things are going to going on in Iraq. There are several tests. The first test is that if things are going badly in Iraq, the Iraqis will start leaving Iraq in droves. You know, I've seen them on many, many occasions in 1969, in 1971, in 1973, and so on. They just leave the villages, and I'm talking of grassroots Iraqis, you know, peasants, people close to the land, not just, for example, intellectuals who might be unhappy with the situation, like me, you know, and leave the country, and so on. By this test, the situation in Iraq at the moment is 50-50, because, you know, many Sunnis have left Iraq. They are become new refugees in Jordan and in Syria, but at the same time, many Shiites and Kurds have come back to Iraq. So the second test is when things are going badly in Iraq, the flow of pilgrims to the holy shrines in Najaf and Karbala slows down and eventually dries up. Nobody is seen there. By this test, the situation in Iraq is good because, you know, since liberation, Iraq has hosted something like 12 million pilgrims from all over the world. You know, Shiites even from Brazil and Australia and come. And, you know, in Najaf, there is a building boom. You know, I wish I had bought an apartment there. And these people are coming in for the first time since the late 1980s. In huge numbers. It makes Iraq the number one tourist destination in the Middle East. You know, you should envy them. So by this test, things are okay. The third test of whether things are going badly or well in Iraq is the status of the Iraqi dinar vis-a-vis the Iranian rial and the Kuwaiti dinar. Vis-a-vis the Iranian rial, because the Iranian rial is needed for pilgrimage, you know, and the Iraqis who want to go to Mashhad, and the Iranians who come to Iraq, they spend the rial, and the Kuwaiti for trade. So in both cases, the Iraqi dinar has appreciated against both of them. And, you know, there is a daily chart of it. You can find it on the internet. Again, I wish I had bought Iraqi dinars, so I didn't.
Many Israelis did.
But the Israelis are always clever. There you go. You see what? I mean, I'm a stupid Iranian. Okay, I'm a stupid Iranian. You are clever Israelis. Anyway, so again, by this test, you know, these guys must know something, that, you know, they are buying these dinars and using them. The fourth, fifth test is when things are going badly in Iraq, suddenly the small businesses disappear. You know, I've seen it in many, many cases. For example, the first the sign of it was when we had the border skirmishes with Iraq in the 1970s, before 1975 Algiers Accord. Every now and then I would go to the border to have a look to see what's happening. And, you know, I found out that suddenly most of the barbers or fruit vendors are all Iraqis. You know, they came, they brought their small businesses to the other side of the border, waiting to see what happens there. But now, I tell you, the World Bank and the IMF published reports on the Iraqi economy saying that this was a booming economy of the region with the growth rates of 57%, 32%, now the lowest 17%, and the engine of growth for the whole region. Most of it is by small businesses. People, you know, have created small shops, cooperatives, import and export businesses, and also the comeback of the Iraqi agriculture. For the first time since the 1950s, Iraq is self-sufficient in food because the command economy collapsed and the peasants, you know, reclaimed their lands and started growing it. And now they are exporting a lot of food to Iran over the border trade. So by this test too, the appearance of thousands of small businesses everywhere, it shows that the situation in Iraq is not as bad as people think. The next test is that whenever things were bad, going badly in Iraq, suddenly Iraq became silent. Nobody would say anything. People were scared of talking. You know, there is a Chelo Kebab restaurant in Baghdad, Shemshad, which is one of my favorites since the 60s. I remember one day under Saddam Hussein, I was sitting there and having lunch with friends, and suddenly the director, Haji Hassan Agha, said, "Please, Mr. Tahiri, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing, I'm having Chelo Kebab." So he said, no, you are talking politics. All my customers fled. You know, as I looked around, the whole restaurant was empty. But today, Iraq is a talking shop. Everybody is talking, and they are talking politics. They love it. You know, this was a silent society that couldn't breathe. Now they talk. They have satellite television. They have mobile phones or cellular phones, as the Americans call it. They have hundreds of newspapers. They have radio talk shows imitated from the Americans, Rush Limbaugh or something like that. Or Israelis, you know, they're constantly complaining, again, like Israelis. They are criticizing their government, like Israelis, you know, and they are doing dealing and wheeling in politics, coalitions, you know, this one is with this one the other day, this one the other, like the Israelis, that if one man leaves the cabinet collapses. You know, the same thing. And for me, you know, I have no personal interest in Iraq. I'm an Iranian, and I could say, you know, I couldn't care less what happens to Iraq. Anyway, they were our enemy. They fought us for 8 years. But, you know, when I go there, I really feel happy that a prisoner nation has been liberated. Now, there are, of course, forces that are against this new Iraq and are against the liberation of this prisoner nation. The Baathists are against it, Al-Qaeda are against it, Pan-Arabists are against it, Khomeinists are against it. That makes a lot of people. And these are killers. You know, they are trying to kill this new Iraq. And our duty is not to allow them to kill this new Iraq. Our duty is to support this new Iraq until it can defend itself. Our duty is not, you know, to constantly attack the leaders of this new Iraq, you know, try to vilify them, humiliate them, say, you know, you have to set benchmarks for them, you know, and the usual things. The U.S. has a moral contract with Iraq. When the Americans arrived in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani issued a fatwa, said, do not oppose their entry. And nothing happened. You know, the Americans just walked into Baghdad. There wasn't any major fighting at all. So the Iraqis said, we have a contract with you. You said, you want to come to this country to liberate us. Our contract with you was to go and vote, to write a new constitution. We have done our part. You have to do your part. Another thing that people forget is that every day, 8.5 million children go to school in Iraq, from kindergarten to university. The terrorists kill some of them. The terrorists kill teachers, but they cannot stop them. Over 600 hospitals in Iraq that had been devastated by war and terrorism are working, are functioning, but again, it never features anywhere in the news. But, you know, doctors go there to hospitals, nurses go there, people go there. They are reviving. Over 260 projects have been completed in Iraq. I don't want to sound like a spokesman for the Pentagon and so on, which I don't like anyway, because I think they made many mistakes. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that whenever I go to Iraq and by accident I go to the United States, it's as if, you know, I'm seeing two different things. You know, and this happened when I was in Iraq last December, and I went to the U.S. Last March. I said, what are you talking about? You know, it is really a mystery to me how culture like the American culture that can persuade 11 million people to eat McDonald's
cannot show the truth of what is happening in Iraq. This is really a big mystery to me.
Well, I think we've run out of time, and I just want to express my appreciation to Amir Tahiri. I want to say that I wish we had a lot more time.
Thank you very much.
Other questions that I would like to also ask, but what can I say? Quickly. Next time, inshallah, as you said. Anyway, thank you again. We'll let you know on the next week.
Thank you.
This is our day.